Thibault's Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. On this edition of PTR, we take a look at the current conflict, the class conflict, and the propaganda and ideas that are used to fight it, with our special guest, Michael Warr.
There is more than one war going on right now. There is a war in Afghanistan, and there's a war, a class war, in America. Ultimately, both are class wars. Accompanying these wars is a propaganda war. It is a statement on our times that CNN is actually using the term propaganda war, absent from anti-communism. But they're only using this terminology in the context of the battle of ideas between the Taliban and the Pentagon. They're not using it in a domestic context. But there is a battle for the hearts and minds of workers around the world. Sometimes the language of this war is subtle. Other times it's like it's wielded like a hammer.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publish the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. Michael Warr was the featured speaker at a recent benefit event for the People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo, in Chicago, Illinois. He was introduced by performance poet Brenda Matthews.
Michael Warr has lectured and recited his poetic works at over 50 colleges and universities. He also lectures on literature and community, censorship, multiculturalism, journalism, leadership transition, the relationship between politics and art, and has produced a series of essays on the immigrant experience and the issue of faith for the Chicago Matter series at Chicago's NPR station. Michael founded and served as executive director of the Guild Complex, an award-winning cross-cultural literary arts center from 1989 to 1999. He remains an editor at its publishing wing, Tia Chucha Press. Michael now works as a consultant. He is currently focusing on coordinating the audiences for Literature Network for the Wallace Reader Digest Funds, House of World Cultures, Black Atlantic Project, and lecturing in the Arts Administration Program at Art Institute Chicago. Dividing his time between his work as an artist, educator, national arts and business consultant, an entrepreneur, he lives in Chicago with his wife, Patricia Zamora. His literary awards include a Gwendolyn Brooks Significant Illinois Poets Award. His first book of poetry, We Are All the Black Boys, has been honored by the Illinois Library Association. His poems are included in anthologies Unsettling America, Race and Ethnicity in Contemporary American Poetry, A Snake in the Heart, Poems and Music by Chicago Spoken Word Performers, which he produced, and many, many others. Michael has won writing residencies to Ragdale and the Atlantic Center for Arts. His poetry has been published and translated in Tri-Quarterly, New American Writing, River Styx, Hammers, Coppages, Strong Coffee, The Baffler, Jackleg Press, and other journal and magazines. Well, we just need to say the brother has it together. You know what I'm saying? I am honored. I am honored. I'm telling you, I am honored to bring this brother to you, none other than our own Mr. Michael Warr. We all give him a wonderful round of applause.
Boy, sorry you had to sit through all that. Oh, Brenda, I just want to say that I'm blown away by you. And it's always about trial and error. Anyway, thanks for being here. I want to thank the People's Tribune and the Tribuno del Pueblo for inviting me. And I want to encourage everybody to give generously to the paper so they can continue their work, which is more vital today, I think, than it's ever been. Tonight I want to talk about unity. I want to talk about class conflict. I want to talk about how ideas reflect and influence that conflict. And I want to talk about the war against new ideas. Everyone's talking about unity today. It's a central theme in our culture. And I just want to start by sharing a few quotes with you that are relevant. The first one's from conservative columnist Linda Chavez, who, referring to the tragedy of September 11th, wrote the following. "The attacks remind us we're all in the same boat. What unites us as Americans is more important than any of the petty divisions of race or ethnic group, of class or profession, of religious or political affiliation. We are not black or white, Asian or Latino, Christian or Jew. We are Americans. We've been indoctrinated with the cult of multiculturalism. We must recommit ourselves to assimilating the millions of newcomers." Sounds like the Borg, right? "You will be assimilated. Resistance is futile." Then there's Bill Moyers, who, to his credit, has for several years been raising the alarm that something is wrong with the soul of democracy in America. In his own words, quote, "The soul of democracy, the essence of the word itself, is government of, by, and for the people. And the soul of democracy has been dying, drowning in a rising tide of big money contributed by a narrow, unrepresentative elite that betrayed the faith of citizens and self-government. But what's happened since September 11th, he says, would seem to put the lie to my fears. Americans have rallied together in a way that I cannot remember since World War II. This catastrophe has reminded us of a basic truth at the heart of our democracy. No matter our wealth, our status, or faith, we are all equal before the law, in the voting booth, and when death rains down from the sky." End of quote. Of course, even some of that could be argued as untrue when it comes to equality in this country, especially in the voting booth. But more importantly, after the statement, Moyers says this, quote, "The ideologues at Heritage, the right-wing think tank, earlier this year teamed up with deep pocket bankers, many from Texas, with ties to the Bush White House, to stop America from cracking down on terrorist money havens. How about that for patriotism? And these people wrap themselves in the flag and sing the Star Spangled Banner with gusto." End of quote. But to me, the most enlightening statement about our newfound unity comes from a U.S. postal worker. She said, "Rain, snow, sleet, or hail, they didn't say nothing about no anthrax." CNN didn't say the name of this woman. But in my opinion, those simple words, in those simple words, she profoundly showed that she captured America today in those simple words. And she also showed that part of her soul where the poet resides. The death of postal workers is not a laughing matter, but the denial by the federal government of the unequal manner in which the institutions of power in Washington were treated, whether they were signs of anthrax or not, compared to the way the postal workers were ill-treated, is definitely laughable. The postal workers have shown, at minimum, a degree of social consciousness in this very confrontational, not united, discourse about their well-being. However, even the class nature of the government's policy is also revealed. Are we united? Let me put it in a bread and butter versus caviar kind of context. Last year, the average poor person's income dropped so far below the official poverty line that it set an all-time record. Almost 500,000 more people filed for unemployment benefits in the first 8 months of this year than in the same period last year. More than 200,000 layoffs have been announced since September 11th, all of this following a record expansion. But seldom is the question asked, expansion for whom? Only 3.6% of national income went to the poorest one-fifth of the households in 2000, tying 1967 for the lowest level on record. That share received by the middle three-fifths set a new low of 47%, while the share received by the one top fifth percent set a new high of 50%. And according to the New York Times, the Congressional Tax Cut Package, which is supposed to resolve all of this, would give a $70 billion out of a $100 billion relief to businesses. The richest 1% of individual taxpayers would get 41% of the 202 tax cuts in the House bill, about $27,000 each, according to Citizens for Tax Justice. The 60% with the lowest incomes would get 7% of the tax cuts. That's about $78 each. So $28,000 over here, $78 on this side. If that's unity, then give me the most chaotic disunity that's available. So we are united, yes, we are united in our horror of the atrocities of September 11th, and we are united in our concern for our future. But beyond that, what are we united about? There is more than one war going on right now. There is a war in Afghanistan, and there's a war, a class war, in America. Ultimately, both are class wars. Accompanying these wars is a propaganda war. It is a statement on our times that CNN is actually using the term propaganda war, absent from anti-communism. But they're only using this terminology in the context of the battle of ideas between the Taliban and the Pentagon. They're not using it in a domestic context. But there is a battle for the hearts and minds of workers around the world. Sometimes the language of this war is subtle. Other times it's like it's wielded like a hammer. How can you have ideological unity when the reality is one of economic disunity, of economic inequality, of economic injustice? This propaganda war is more evident than I've seen it during my lifetime. It's pervasive and it touches our everyday lives. On the other hand, it's far more abstract and relatively removed than what we're used to. Issues that were not widely discussed before are now fair game. Just a few kind of noteworthy examples of this, kind of the abstract part of this information and ideological exchange that's going on. First of all, the scholarly book Taliban, which was written by Ahmed Rashid, is currently on the New York Times bestseller list. It's also being sold at Costco. Normally, this book would have sold a couple of thousand copies. It sold 600,000 copies. And Americans are discussing what's going on in the world today. And as much as the network news sucks, most people are actually, many people are actually following it more than ever before. And maybe some of them will, in response to listening to how subjective and narrow this coverage is, start searching for alternative sources as well. So I think this is a positive thing. When the former heavyweight boxing champion Muhammad Ali, who was a Muslim, visited the ruins of the World Trade Center, a reporter asked him how he felt about the suspects sharing his Islamic faith. Ali responded, "How do you feel about Hitler sharing yours?" Ouch! I mean, that's Muhammad Ali saying that. The Pentagon is hiring Hollywood to help it imagine terrorist scenarios. A commentator on CNN explained, if you are going to change the future, you have to first imagine it. If you are going to change the future, you have to first imagine it. We all know that's true. But I could swear this is something I heard Nelson Perry say at some point. So the CNN commentators are quoting communists, quoting revolutionaries now. Of course, it all comes down to what kind of future you envision. Earlier I said we are united in our concern about the future. That's true, but don't assume there's unity about what that future should look like. Did you hear what Ann Coulter, formerly of the National Review, said after the attack? She said, "This is no time to be precious about locating the exact individuals directly involved in this particular terrorist attack. Those responsible include anyone anywhere in the world who smiled in response to this annihilation of patriots. We should invade their countries, kill their leaders, and convert them to Christianity." Do you think she sees the same future as you? Or wants the same future as you? There's a battle for the future. That's why Colin Powell distinguishes between the uncivilized and the civilized world every time he speaks. That's why President Bush, who claims to be against all terrorism, still has found it necessary to specifically condemn radical terrorism. If you're against all terrorism, why qualify the word? Because this is not just a war against terror. It is a part of a class war. This is a war just as much about meaning as it is about property, oil, power, and retribution. What does terror mean? When it fits the interests of U.S. foreign policy to underwrite terrorism in Afghanistan to oust the Soviets, terror was acceptable, not evil. Brzezinski, the national security advisor under Carter, has recently said that ousting communism was worth arming future terrorists, which is exactly what happened. When State Department counterterrorist coordinator Michael Sheehan was asked to define terrorism, he said, in a war, if military forces are attacking each other, it's not terrorism. But if an armed terrorist organization attacks civilian targets, that's terrorism. Or it's a terrorist attack if you attack military people in barracks, such as the Khobar bombings on the Marine barracks in 1982. Those are terrorist acts. Each case is taken on a case-by-case basis. The reporter asked, so for example, if the United States were to drop, what do you call them, cruise missiles on the people who are in barracks or in tents or as it may be, would that be terrorism? Could that be terrorism? Sheehan said, no. This exchange took place over a year ago. There was actually laughter in the room at Sheehan's response. And that was not included in the transcript of the briefing from the State Department. But the laughter could be heard when this segment was played on C-SPAN radio. Again, not a laughing matter, but laughable. George Bush qualifies the type of terrorism he's against because in a historical sense, if it were not for terrorism, America would not be the power that it is today. America might not even exist if it was not for terrorism. Consider the irony that the U.S. government is now preparing to combat potential smallpox weaponry when biological warfare in the form of smallpox was waged against the Indians, reducing warriors from 30,000 to 300 in New England years before even their arrival on Plymouth Rock. The point is, where there are class interests at stake, there is also an ideological battle. George Bush would never refer to the use of smallpox against the Indians, which is a kind of ethnic cleansing, as terrorism. In fact, I dare you to find a reference in most history books to this incident. We are in a war over ideas, and that is why, on the one hand, we are in a very exciting period of new ideas being openly discussed and distributed, while at the same time, we are experiencing a new wave of censorship and repression. The type of terrorism that's being qualified, this terrorism is being qualified because swiftly and silently it has been redefined for domestic use. Thus, we come to the USA Patriot Act, which stands for the uniting and strengthening America by providing appropriate tools required to intercept and obstruct terrorism. If you are not familiar with these new powers given to the Attorney General, the FBI, and the CIA, I strongly encourage you to read them soon. I just want to give you a sampling of some of the interpretations of parts of this new act. It permits the Attorney General to incarcerate or detain non-citizens based on mere suspicion and deny readmission to the U.S. of non-citizens, including lawful permanent residents, for engaging in speech protected by the Fifth Amendment. It expands the ability of the government to conduct secret searches, again in anti-terrorist investigations, and in routine criminal investigations unrelated to terrorism. This means that law enforcement authorities can enter and search an individual's home without presenting a warrant or in any way informing the subject of the search. It gives the Attorney General and the Secretary of State the power to designate domestic groups as terrorist organizations and to block any non-citizen who belongs to them from entering the country. It grants the FBI broad access to sensitive medical, financial, mental health, and educational records about individuals without having to show evidence of a crime or without a court order. It puts the CIA and other intelligence agencies back in the business of spying on Americans by giving the director of the Central Intelligence the authority to identify priority targets for intelligence surveillance in the United States. It allows searches of highly personal financial records without notice and without judicious review based on a very low standard that does not require probable cause of a crime or even relevancy to an ongoing investigation of terrorism. It allows students' records to be searched and based on a very low standard of relevancy to an investigation. And it creates a broad new definition of domestic terrorism that could target people who engage in acts of political protest and subject them to wiretapping and enhanced penalties. So where do you fit in the context of the U.S. Patriot Act? Are you a terrorist? What does all this mean to those who are battling for the poor? What might it mean to the president of the Postal Union? One writer, using Martin Luther King as a political barometer, has written that King would have been subject to investigation under these rules, although we already know he was wiretapped, and more than that. We can learn something about how dangerous a new idea can be from the way that the final years of King's life are addressed or not addressed by our cultural and media institutions, since it was during that period that King was waging a poor people's campaign. First, he was ostracized. He was basically condemned for his new ideas. Why? Well, he began to look beyond color to class. In his Beyond Vietnam speech in 1967, he called America, quote, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, end of quote. And he referred, quote, to the capitalists of the West investing in Asia, Africa, and South America only to take huge profits with no concern for the betterment of those countries, end of quote. But perhaps the most damaging from the perspective of those members of the ruling class who had previously praised him, King started talking about restructuring society, literally saying that, quote, an edifice that produces beggars needs reconstructing. When he began to form what he called a, quote, multiracial army of the poor to descend upon Washington, the Reader's Digest warned of an insurrection. So first he was made into a pariah, which effectively set the cultural, ideological, and propaganda environment in which he was assassinated. This was the reaction to his ideas changing. The U.S. Patriot Act is not only about planes being flown into buildings, it is about the threats of changing ideas. It is about unity, or the real lack of that. It's about class conflict, and on many levels, it's about ideas changing in this country. Here's a simple example of this transformation post-September 11. There was an interview with a young person working on Wall Street who, when asked about his life post-September 11, said, "My life was ruled by the stock market. I measured success by what college I could attend. I measured success by my starting salary. Now how do I feel?" A fireman asked what I did, and then I did not want to say my job, tax analyst. Nothing against tax analysts, but this experience represents an opening for a shift in this individual's consciousness. And I think this applies across society. And this is a shift that's drastically needed. Consider this. According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, nearly 36,000 children died on September 11, totally separate from the bombing of the World Trade Center. There were no television programs about these children, no newspaper articles, no message from the president, no acts of solidarity, no message from the Pope, no alert level, and no military mobilization. When Americans spend their money, it's an indicator of what they think is important. The day before September 11th, the Red Cross received $1,000 in donations. Within 2 weeks, it had raised $202 million. Within a month, that doubled. By November, all donations associated with September 11th reached over $2 billion. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Resources, more than 600,000 people go to bed homeless in America every night. I praise all the artists who have come forward and donated their talent to the victims of the World Trade Center tower attack. Over $150 million was raised in one of these events. The social ills, the programs of the problems of the poor and the destitute are not irresolvable. We have the money, we have the vision, we have the know-how, we have the technology, we have all the resources necessary to resolve these problems. Clearly, what is lacking is a government and a system willing to mobilize these resources on behalf of the poor. And there is a profound lack of general will. In fact, when people found out that not all of the $500 million that went to the Red Cross was going to go to the victims of September 11th, but would instead be distributed across the different issues or concerns that the Red Cross addresses, many of them wanted their money back. We are in more than one war. I haven't quoted Martin Luther King much in my life, but we all have quoted "I Have a Dream" somewhere, you know. And I think that that quote should always be followed by King's other, forgotten, underreported, not as catchy quote, quote, "An edifice that produces beggars needs restructuring." We need an artist to restructure that quote, maybe. But the meaning of that quote can be profound. I know I've not talked much specifically about art, but art takes place within a culture. And if we are in a culture where it takes the tragic death of 6,000 innocent Americans for our hearts to be moved, then we are doomed. Our art must move Americans to be as outraged by the slow, invisible death that culminates in the death of 36,000 children in one day, as they are by what one kindergarten child described to her teacher as the birds on fire as she watched from a distance at her schoolyard people jumping out of the World Trade Building. I listened to Charles Ogle on CBS talk about getting back to normal. He said, "We want to go back to the world we remember." That ain't gonna happen. That world is gone. But I don't even want to go back to it if we could. We have to envision a world better than the one that created the conditions that would make such terror imaginable. Thank you.
Michael Rohr, speaking at a recently concluded benefit event for the People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo, in Chicago, Illinois. That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society where the very technologies of computerization and robotics that are now being used to displace millions of workers worldwide are used for the benefit of humanity as a whole. If you'd like more information about the League or our other print and audio publications, you can contact us by calling 1-800-691-6888. That number once again, 1-800-691-6888. Or visit us on the web at www.lrna.org. My name is Mike Thornton, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.